I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, it's our On Congress segment. We'll check in with a congressional reporter about the latest news from the Capitol.
But first, we're talking about an agreement on the farm bill that could end a two-year impasse in Congress.
Today, the U.S. House of Representatives passed the bill. The Senate is expected to take it up next week.
On top of that news, it's also Ag Day in Wisconsin's capital.
Earlier today, we spoke with Jim Holt, president of the Wisconsin Farm Bureau Federation, about how that farm bill could affect Wisconsin's farmers.
Jim, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you for the offer to join you today.
Well, you've come out in support of the agreement reached on the farm bill. Why are you behind the legislation?
Well, the Farm Bill, as many people know, has been something that's been in progress for 2 to 3 years. And that may be partially because there's a number of different major changes in the Farm Bill this year over past Farm Bills. Many of those, I think, are very positive. And, of course, the Congress has had trouble agreeing on most anything lately, but they finally have come to a consensus on this one in the Conference Committee. And I believe we're expecting a vote on the House side yet today. So we're happy that it's coming to a vote, and we think there's a lot of positive things in it.
Well, what are you most excited about?
Well, I think one of the major changes is that the federal government in their ag policy is moving away from what's been called direct payments to farmers, and taking a much bigger role in helping farmers manage risk. And I think that's very appropriate in our current times. I would like to emphasize helping farmers manage risk, not eliminate risk. Risk needs to be in every business, and agriculture is the same as all other businesses. So it is a major change, but I think it's a very positive thing.
So let's zoom in on that direct payment to farmers, which was the way it's been done until this bill. What was that program, and how will its end change things for Wisconsin farmers?
Well, that program involved having each farmer having a base in the major grain crops, most commonly here corn and soybeans, and a certain amount of payment being sent on a basis of that base to each farmer each year. And it really didn't reflect the ups or downs of the markets. It didn't reflect what the demand for those products was telling farmers to produce. It was just kind of an arbitrary number. And it very much got built into rental payments. For instance, many farmers rent land from others, and it just increased the cost of the rental payment. And so it didn't necessarily positively impact farmers that greatly, other than land they already owned. Now, when we go to a program that has a much greater emphasis on managing risk, it's something that can help every producer, but in a way that doesn't involve them receiving a check from the government. So I think those are positive things.
Well, as you said, this bill is more than 2 years overdue. How do you think that delay has affected the agricultural industry here in Wisconsin?
Well, to a certain extent, it's been frustrating, and frustrating from a point of view that it doesn't allow farmers to plan how they will manage and how they will change their farming operations. The certainty of what the bill is now, if it does pass, and we think it will, the certainty going forward for a number of years does allow us to do a better job of planning and managing as every farm needs to do.
Now, let's talk about another area of this bill, and that would be the federal dairy regulations. What's changed there?
There's probably been as much or more change in the dairy side as any other title in the Farm Bill. For a long time, the federal government has assisted in maintaining a price or supporting a price for dairy farmers by buying different cheese, butter, non-fat milk products, and also by having a program called the MILC, which sent payments to farmers when the price was extremely depressed. That is being either eliminated or phased out and going to a program where, again, it helps farmers manage their risk by making an insurance-type product available when the margin between a farmer's feed costs and their price of milk they're receiving gets to a certain level. Again, it helps them manage that risk, and I think that's a very positive thing.
Now, there was some back and forth about the best way to handle this. How do you feel with what is in the current bill?
Well, to be very honest, the summary of that farm bill is 190 pages, so I haven't read the whole thing. That's the summary. But from the generalities I've heard is that there was a lot of compromise going on between the conferees of the House and the Senate. And they've come to a point where they've actually added some items that was not in either bill from the House and Senate, and so we're still kind of trying to get our arms around those and understand them completely. But as I just explained previously, the move is away from buying of products by the government from those specific products more and more towards helping us manage risk.
Now, does that address the problem of what happens and what happens to production when demand for milk is low?
It does. There is still a certain part of this program that will involve the government buying some product, removing it from the market, and donating it to food programs. That's in contrast to in the past when they bought product, they would resell it on the market when prices rebounded some. It does create a certain amount of a cost for the government, but it also has the added benefit of providing food to different programs and people that are in need of it. So I think that's a little bit of a change in what was in either the House or Senate bill. They also have made the decision not to include a supply management program in the program. That was a discussion point that took a long time to resolve, apparently.
Now, looking at a different aspect of this farm bill, one of the things that has been bundled in with it is the issue of food stamps, and this was also one of the most contentious parts going forward. What is your opinion on the cuts in the new farm bill to the SNAP program?
Well, to be frank, we are most interested and focused basically on the ag portions of the farm bill. You're right, the SNAP program is not only a part, it is the major part of this bill, because I think if you were to look at the total cost of the bill over 10 years, about 80% of it is related to the SNAP program. And yet, as an organization, we tend to concentrate on the issues that impact agriculture directly, and so we don't heavily get involved in the discussions about the SNAP program.
Do you expect that to be a major conversation point as the bill gets voted on?
Being it's as large a portion of the cost, I would expect it very much would be, yes.
What do you think about having that bundled in there? Is that just politics as usual?
Well, I guess there's different ways you can look at it. One way is that the agricultural community has looked at it for a period of time is that if you had a bill that only dealt with ag programs, there's a large number of congresspeople that really have very little ag, if any ag, in their district, and they may not have any interest in the bill at all. When it's combined with a food program that impacts every congressional district, every senatorial district, there's a more general interest and a more likelihood that those elected officials will take an interest and participate in crafting a good bill. So we think there is value to keeping these two parts together.
Now, have you gotten any reaction so far? It hasn't been voted on, but there has been an agreement reached. What kind of reaction are you getting from Wisconsin farmers so far?
Well, I think it's a little bit early. Our statement in support just went out yesterday. I'm likely to get some reaction when we get together for our Ag Day today, but I haven't really yet.
The House is expected to vote on this bill tonight. How optimistic are you that this is going to pass?
Historically, farm bills are not strongly partisan issues. They are based on programs that seem to be of general consensus, both on the farm side and the food stamp side. I'm quite optimistic it will pass. It's been a long time coming and a lot of thought put into it, so I think there's a very good chance it will pass.
Now, what about Wisconsin lawmakers? How are they reacting to the bill?
We have been in contact with each of our congresspeople and senators, urging them to support it. We have not received a lot of feedback yet because the compromise was just reached, I believe, on Monday afternoon. So we look forward to that response and hope that it's positive.
Well, it's an interesting day to focus on this because it is Ag Day at the state capitol. What are you expecting to hear in Madison today?
Well, we tend to focus at Ag Day on state issues, and that's the case again today. The implements of husbandry draft legislation is one that we'll have a fair amount of discussion about, I'm sure. in general, the other ag programs and things that have been supported by the Department of Ag and our governor, we discussed. Governor Walker is going to join us to be our featured speaker early this afternoon. I'm looking forward to hear what his comments are.
Excellent. Well, Jim, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for the invitation.
That was Jim Holt, president of the Wisconsin Farm Bureau Federation, talking about the farm bill that passed the U.S. House today.
Veronica talked to him this morning before it passed the U.S. House. As we just heard from the president of the Wisconsin Farm Bureau, Congress has agreed on a bipartisan farm bill. Now it's time for a weekly update on Congress with USA Today politics and Congress editor Paul Singer.
Last night, President Obama addressed the House and Senate for over an hour and laid out ways in which he both planned to sidestep Congress and ways in which he wants to see Congress move forward on top priorities, including immigration.
Here with us now to break down all that news is Paul Singer. Paul, welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you. How you guys doing?
Really good. Well, before we get to that State of the Union, Congress has agreed to a farm bill. House just passed it today. It took a little while. What happened to finally make that pass?
Well, you know, farm bills, everybody wants them. There's something in it for everybody sooner or later. And there's only so long they can operate without some sort of decisions on subsidies and farm support payments and food stamps. I mean, this is $500 billion worth of legislation. You can't just sort of slough it off forever. I think this has taken about 2 years to assemble this one. So they were going to do it sooner or later, and they finally basically, split the difference in some of their major arguments, particularly food stamps, and decided to get it done.
Yeah, speaking of food stamps, why was that such a major sticking point here?
Well, this became a target for significant budget cutting, particularly by Republicans in the House last year. The Senate had passed a farm bill with about $4.5 billion worth of cuts in food stamps. That got added to in the House, and before they were done adding amendments and adding other cuts, they had managed to eliminate about $40 billion, that's 40 billion, about 10 times what the Senate had passed. And the Democrats weren't going to live with that, and there was even some Republicans were nervous about it. There was a whole stalemate at that point. Well, between 4 and 40, where do we go? And, of course, the Democrats were afraid the Republicans were just sort of trying to push them to 20. They ended up at somewhere around 8. So, it's a cut. It's a significant cut, but it's not the catastrophic cuts the Democrats had been worried about.
As I had heard, the House was maybe the last potential obstacle. Do you think this will fly through the Senate now?
Yeah. I mean, I think you'll hear people complain, and I think you'll hear people very upset about the cuts, particularly food stamps. But, yes, I think it'll fly through the Senate. I think everyone feels like this is the deal.
And another thing the House passed, this time before the State of the Union last night, the House passed an anti-abortion bill. First of all, what did they do? What did they pass the House?
I believe this is the bill that prevents using federal funds for abortions, particularly in health care coverage. You will note that I am not particularly expert in this bill, particularly because it's not going to matter. Mm-hmm. It's not going to pass. The Senate's never going to pass it. The president's never going to sign it. These are what we call message bills. Whichever party is in power gets the opportunity to pass bills, even if they don't think they've got the votes in the other chamber to pass them.
So why do they pass them if they're not going to pass?
Well, because it gives you an opportunity when you go on the campaign trail to say, I voted for this, my opponent voted against it, and it reasserts your appeal to your base. It says, listen, this is a principle issue. We believe in this principle, and we're going to continue to pass it and continue to vote on it, even though it's never going to become law. I mean, the House Republicans have voted, I don't know, like 40 times, I think we've said now, on repealing Obamacare or various sort of delays to Obamacare. None of those are going to become law, but it is part of their messaging. They are trying to make the point that they are very sincere about this topic, and they want to see change, and they will continue to vote for change. And Democrats, by the way, are going to continue to vote against change, and that's what they want them on the record doing.
Leading up to elections, a lot of groups issue scorecards on candidates. Do these message bills end up being fodder for these scorecards from liberal and conservative groups?
They certainly do. But I will tell you that the proliferation of those scorecards makes them a little less meaningful. if everybody is issuing a scorecard, you know, how do you decide on your candidate when they've got an A plus from the Farm Bureau and an A minus from the, I don't know, Freedom to Fish League, and a C from the abortion group, and a D minus from the tax group? You know, I mean, like, they're sort of, they're all over the place. So, but yes, that's what they call, they call them key votes. But again, some of these, they won't even bother to select, because the vote is fairly easy in this case, honestly. It's fairly easy for the Democrats to say this is not something that's going to affect law, and besides which is already in the law. And it's easy for Republicans to say, well, this is an important philosophical principle. So they're easy votes.
All right. Well, on we go to the big news for Congress last night. They got to sit and listen to the State of the Union. So as much as President Obama would like to have been setting the agenda for Congress for the last 5 years or so, at this point, how much sway does he have to get them to take any kind of action?
Well, not much. I mean, I think what he has is the bully pulpit, right? And he can make this case, a strong case, that income inequality is a problem that should be addressed. Maybe raising the minimum wage is something that Congress should do. He can say, I'm taking executive action on my own where I can, which is what he did last night. And he's now out today and tomorrow doing campaign stops around the country to try and make that case that these are important issues, we should get Congress to vote on them. But I think the real theme of last night's speech was, I don't need you, Congress. I'm going to do some of this myself. And I think in Obama's case, he needs to sort of demonstrate action. It's been a rough 6 months for the administration, maybe a rough year for the administration. He needs to be able to demonstrate action. So he's out there doing that. He issued this 15-page, I think it was, a memo last night of executive actions that he's taken, everything from creating new task forces to issuing executive orders to address issues where Congress won't act.
We've seen some response to those executive actions from Republicans in Congress, not happy about them. How much of that is just partisan politics, and how much of it is maybe a sense from people in Congress that, hey, the executive shouldn't be stepping on our toes and going it alone?
Well, there's this running joke, you know, about members of Congress who go to the White House and suddenly discover that, you know, the years they were in Congress screaming about executive power, now they're in the White House, they start screaming about congressional encroachment on their power. I mean, that's just what happens. Presidents love executive authority. All presidents, no matter what party they're from. And Obama is trying to flex his muscle. Congress, of any party, hates executive authority when it's being asserted by the other party. You know, this is the way this works. Obviously, Congress is going to make the argument that these are things that Congress needs to do and that Obama needs their approval to do. He's going to argue, no, they're not. I mean, I don't know if you remember, several years ago when Bush was still president, he was doing what they called signing statements, which Obama has continued, even though Democrats screamed about him then. And these were signing statements where when he'd sign a bill, he would add a note saying, oh, yeah, but I'm not going to enforce this part, and this part, and I interpret this part differently than you do. Drove Congress nuts, particularly Democrats in Congress. Well, now Obama's doing the same thing, and Democrats are quiet about it.
Wanted to wrap up with one thing out of the State of the Union that might get, apparently, some bipartisan support, immigration reform. We've seen some cooperation on a spending bill, now the farm bill. Is immigration reform the next one that the parties are going to pass something on?
I'm not putting any money on it. I mean, this morning, Marco Rubio, at a presentation before some reporters, said, I don't know if it's going to happen this year because, basically, Republicans don't trust Obama to enforce the border security portions. And for Republicans, border security is a critical issue in any immigration package, and if they don't believe Obama's going to seriously enforce it, they won't vote for the bill. So that is the first signal of, like, well, they're already backing away. But we do expect Republicans in the next couple of days to come out with their outline of what might be required for a bill. Maybe that's a place to get started. We'll see.
Is there a sense that there's election pressure? Are politicians, congresspeople on either side looking over their shoulders saying, we got to get something done or we might get voted out?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think for Republicans, the bigger concern is getting something done that would get them voted out. Their concern is passing anything that could be perceived as amnesty for, you know, 11 or 12 million undocumented immigrants. That would be a death knell in almost any Republican primary. even in the general election might be a problem for them in some cases. So I think they are very cautious about what they're willing to sign on to. And again, if you don't believe this president is serious about enforcing border security provisions, you might just decide, well, heck, we're better off waiting until the next president, who hopefully will be a Republican.
We'll leave it there, Paul, until next week. Thanks a lot for joining us again.
My pleasure. Be well, Rob.
You too. That's Paul Singer, USA Today politics and Congress editor. He tweets from @SingerNews. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. When your child asks for a snack, what do you reach for? Helping of crackers, chips, or a handful of fresh fruit?
Our next guest is a journalist who moved to Italy 12 years ago. But it wasn't until her son was born that she realized the Italian way of child rearing is much different from our own when it comes to food. And she says, more healthy, too.
Jeannie Marshall is the author of The Lost Art of Feeding Kids, What Italy Taught Me About Why Children Need Real Food. Jeannie, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, thank you.
Well, what was your first clue that Italian parents do things differently when it comes to food?
Well, it was really when my son was a baby and he was about to eat solid foods for the first time. And I realized that we were, you know, that people like me, the other Canadian and American expats, were all set to just give them one food at a time, you know, a little bit of broccoli or some horrible mushy thing, just one single thing, some bland food. And here were all of these Italian mothers opening up containers with this food that smelled incredible. It had, you know, not so much herbs, but had flavorings like onion and garlic, and they were stirring a little bit of Parmesan cheese into it.
Wow.
And this is what they were giving their babies. It was much more complex and actually tasted good. And I thought, okay, that's a whole different way of approaching it. You know, they're actually thinking about teaching their kids to like food, you know, rather than just to nourish them.
But that's what they teach you to do. All the baby books say, do give the one single mushy food and give it for 2 weeks straight before you move on to the next one.
Yeah, and I did do that at first, I have to admit. And I think that's because we're all worried about allergies, and allergies certainly are a big concern. But they are not as much of a concern in Italy and Europe generally. And, you know, that's changing as more, you know, who knows why exactly. I mean, my own, you know, guess is that as their eating habits become more like ours in North America, they're also suffering similar problems. But they don't worry about the allergies so much. What they worry about more is that the child eat and enjoy the food. You know, and that was a new way for me to look at it.
Here in the United States, there's a really big division between kid food and grown-up food. Did you see that in at least the more traditional Italian meals?
No, there's no kid food. That's the amazing thing. The kid food is all very new and very packaged, and it probably didn't exist, you know, even, I'm not sure how long it's been here, but it's new to Italy. So certainly when families get together, they just they feed the children the same thing that the adults are eating. And if they're really small kids, they just puree it for them. So they can have, you know, a whole three-course meal pureed.
Wow, and so the kids, how do they take to this food right away? It seems, you know, from an American perspective, sort of like a tough sell if you're giving them something that has some herbs in it, some cheese, different textures. It seems like the kids might reject it. How do the Italian kids do with this?
Well, for the most part, you know, they're learning to be Italian children in a way, and so they accept it because they don't know any different, for one thing, and because they see everyone else around them eating it, so they eat it too. They tend to eat well from, you know, just from my own casual observations. And of course, there's always, you know, a child who maybe doesn't like a certain thing. Every once in a while, I'll meet an Italian who doesn't like pasta, and it just shocks me, you know. And they'll say, no, you know, even from childhood, I didn't like it. So those sorts of things happen, but that's the rare occasion. It's usually, you know, the child just eats it up, and the more they're introduced to it, the more they like it. Vegetables are always the thing. Even with Italian parents, you know, there has to be a certain amount of, you know, encouragement. But even then, I think it's because everyone here eats vegetables that they see them as normal, and so they eat them as well. They eat them too. There's a lot less fussing and fighting, it seems, over the table, for sure.
It sounds in some ways like more work because you don't have those quick, easy, prepared foods that you can just buy and serve. On the other hand, it sounds like less work because you're preparing the same meal for the grown-ups and the kids. You're not trying to prepare two different dishes at the same time. How did it shake out as far as how much time it took to feed kids?
You know, it's probably the same. It's true that sometimes it is a little bit more work, that you can't just throw something in your purse and go. You know, or you can, but you have to prepare it first. But if you're feeding a child, if you're making, you know, dinner for your family, And say you're making, I don't know, in Italy maybe you would make a risotto or you would make a soup or something like that. You just take a little bit out, and with one of those little hand mixers, which I only recently bought and I really like, you know, it would have been great when I had a child, or when I had an infant, and you just puree it, and in a second the child has the same thing you have, but in a form that they can swallow it in that makes it easier for them. And, you know, I have a friend right now who has a 2-year-old, and I watched her feeding her son. And really, she just takes things off of her plate and gives them to him if she's in a restaurant. Or at home, she does the same thing, prepares him a little plate with the same food. So really, I'd say overall, it's easier. It's really easier.
So one of the big trends that you saw was that in Italy, parents would feed their children what we would call whole foods. They weren't processed. They were things that they had cooked. And one of the critiques, you know, that some people say is that it's impossible to really do that in America with the demands on parents. You often have two working families. Do you just have to spend night and day cooking if you want your kids to eat well or to eat like Italians?
Well, I think the Italians are very clever in so many ways, and that during the week, people seem to make very simple food. It's not really that complicated. On the weekend, you know, often people make more complex things. And in fact, I just wrote about that, making tortellini with a friend, and it was a big ordeal. It was a whole weekend long, and it was fantastic, and we had children with us, and they helped us make it. And it was really fun and really worth the effort. But during the week, more often, you know, people don't spend more than, you know, 40 minutes, maybe an hour at the most. I'm really disorganized and slow, and, you know, I don't usually spend more than an hour preparing dinner. But most of my friends would say, no, you know, half an hour, that's it. You know, if you're making pasta, certainly often people just make very simple sauces that they can make in the time it takes to boil the pasta. Or if they're cooking a risotto, it's also very easy, and you just prepare some vegetables to go with it. So mostly I think it's sometimes that we put too much pressure on ourselves to create something that we might eat in a restaurant or something that has to be more complicated, when really it doesn't have to be that complicated. Just simple food, you know, just as long as it tastes good. I think that's the main thing. That's all you really have to worry about.
You're not worried about this, though, just as a matter of taste. You're worried about the health outcomes. What do you think the two different paths, the American way and the, at least the traditional Italian way, lead to?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I have to say traditional Italian way because, of course, it's changing here, too. It is that, you know, a lot more processed foods and junk foods are making their way into children's diets here, and they're having the same problems, certainly. But I just think, you know, you can see it in, they're starting to have the same kind of health problems that we've already had. You know, we should almost be a cautionary tale to them, you know, to say, look, if you're going to introduce all of these, you know, junk foods, sugary foods, processed foods into your diet, and it's not even just the foods, but it's a way of eating as well. Italians generally tended to eat meals, 3 meals a day. Maybe a couple of snacks for children, but now there's such a, you know, promotion of snacking culture, and that's, I think, something that's being imported as well, so that you're eating more often and maybe, you know, not eating as well as you should. And certainly now there are 1 in 3 Italian children suffering overweight and obesity, the same kind of rise in diabetes, same sort of health problems that we've seen in America are starting to happen in Europe as well.
Could you walk us through a day with a, let's say, a typical 5-year-old? What might a typical 5-year-old eat on a school day?
Okay. Well, you know, in some ways, this is what I think is great. I always thought I was going to have to cook everything until my son went to school and I realized there was this amazing lunch program in the school. So a child in the morning will have breakfast. It's right now, I think breakfast is probably the worst meal here. It's really been degraded, and so a lot of kids tend to have sugary things in the morning. And there's this idea that sugar gives them energy. So that's probably that's an unfortunate thing that has changed. I've asked people about what they used to eat in the morning, and it was more, you know, fruit, yogurt, cheeses, even meat, prosciutto, things like that in the morning. So that's changed for sure. But then when the child goes to school, they usually have a snack. So at my son's school, we actually did a communal snack so that each parent takes responsibility for 2 weeks to provide the snack for the class. And so, again, we brought things like prosciutto and cheese and fruit and bread and olive oil and things like that. And then they have lunch, and their lunch is great. It's only one menu. They don't get to choose, so they have a first course, which is either risotto, a pasta, or a soup, and it always involves vegetables, and then a second course, which is maybe a little bit of meat or a bit of fish or frittata or some cheese and some vegetables. And then to finish the meal, they have a piece of fruit, and they just have water to drink with it. So that's actually really nice. And it's nice that I don't have to worry about packing his lunch. It's not, it's easier for me that he has that at school. Then they have a similar snack in the afternoon to what they may have had in the morning. And then, you know, it's dinner. So the one meal I have to send him off to school with, you know, breakfast. Certainly he's had breakfast. Then school looks after him. Then he comes home and I give him a little snack and we make dinner. So it's really not that onerous. It's not as difficult as if, you know, you have a child who goes to school and you have to pack all the food for them. That's actually a big deal. That is difficult.
We're talking with Jeannie Marshall. Her new book is The Lost Art of Feeding Kids, What Italy Taught Me About Why Children Need Real Food.
And we'd like you to join in the conversation. What tricks do you use to try to get your kids to eat real food? Have they learned to love it? And what makes it difficult, do you think, to feed our children well here in America? What could we learn, do you think, from other countries, Italy included? Let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@wpr.org. We're talking with Jeannie Marshall. She's the author of The Lost Art of Feeding Kids, What Italy Taught Me About Why Children Need Real Food.
And we hope you'll join the conversation. Are you looking for tips to get your kids to eat more healthfully? Have you traveled around the world and noticed how other cultures' relationship with food is maybe different from our own? Are you from another country? What was your first impression of food here in the United States? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@wpr.org.
Jeannie, what are the obstacles to, you know, good nutritional whole food for kids here in the United States is the cost. It's how much it costs. It tends to be more expensive to buy fresh fruits and veggies, to say nothing of going organic. How does that square away in Italy?
I think it's a little bit different here. Certainly, organic is always a little bit more expensive than the inorganic food. But fresh fruit and vegetables tend not to be that expensive here. And I think that's partly because they're local and they have a long growing season here as well. You know, it's a fortunate country in that way. It's probably like California, you know, that has that kind of climate. And so there's food that's grown all year round and there's just so much of it. So, in fact, here it's probably easier to eat that sort of food. And that's probably why they do eat more food, more fresh food like that. So I'd say, you know, the real obstacle is also just, you know, the way that food is grown and the priorities that it are given to commodity crops and all the subsidies that are given to the food companies as well and to industrial farming rather than, you know, giving those sorts of subsidies to organic food or to, you know, growing more varieties and fresher food for people, you know, more healthy food in that sense.
There's been there's been a priority in the United States to have cheap food. That's been a federal priority among others. Do you get the sense that Italians spend more money on food in general and that they're willing to do it because they place that value on it?
Well, it's funny. I've actually just been writing an article about the economic crisis here and how that's affecting people's eating habits. And what I'm seeing is a lot of people don't have much money to spend. But the interesting thing that that people are doing, many people, certainly there's been a boom in home gardens. People have even taken over abandoned land to grow food of their own because they value it so much. They understand the need for fresh food. But also, even people in the market, I talk to them, what are they doing? And it's like, well, you know, I'm not eating as much meat as I used to because that's expensive. So instead, they're going back to some more traditional foods like the minestra, the soup that you make with vegetables. And often it's made with the bits of vegetables that you might throw out, like the leaves from the broccoli, the core of the cauliflower. It can be any kinds of vegetables. And they make this delicious soup that really all it takes is time because it has to cook for a couple of hours. And then you might throw in some beans and grate a little bit of Parmesan cheese in it. And it's delicious. It's very traditional. It probably, I don't know, it probably costs maybe, you know, €2. I'm not sure what that is in dollars exactly, but it's quite cheap to feed 4 people, a big hearty bowl of soup. And if you stir a little bit of pasta in it too, it's quite satisfying. It's really good.
We're talking with Jeannie.
I think they have that skill as well to be able to do that. They know how to do that.
We're talking with Jeannie Marshall right now about her new book, The Lost Art of Feeding Kids, about lessons we might learn here in in America about how to feed children healthy, nutritional, whole foods. And we want to know what you think about this at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Why do you think it can be hard to feed kids in America, at least feed kids healthy foods that lead to good health and to good habits? 1-800-642-1234. And we go now to Judy, who's joining us in Bloomer. Hi, Judy.
Hi, how are you this cold day?
Doing okay. How are you?
I'm warming up. I just really have a comment to make. My children are all in their late 40s and early 50s, and I have to admit that I was a stay-at-home mom until they were in middle school. But even after I went to work, I always cooked meal from scratch. I never used processed foods. Everybody ate the same thing. Nobody had a choice. We didn't have a menu where the kids get this and mom and dad get this. We all sat down at the table and talked about what went on during the day. And that's the way everybody ate. And I honestly can't remember when things changed here in the United States, unless it was when more women went out to work.
All right. Although, thank you, Judy. So Judy's pointing to a culture change there, maybe we used to eat more like Italians a generation or two ago, but something in our food culture shifted. Do you think that's true, Jeannie?
I think that's very true. In fact, I wrote about that in the book, my own experience as a child. I grew up in Canada. And I do remember my mother making big pots of soup and cooking much more at home. And it was, in fact, sometimes the food in Italy reminded me a lot of what I ate when I was growing up. But there was a change, certainly, and it's happened at different times and maybe at different times in different families as well. And for us, probably in the 1970s was when that change seemed to affect my family a little bit more.
Thanks for the call, Judy. We're going to go now to Boyd in Wautoma. Boyd, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Rob. Hi, Veronica. You know, there are actually two things I just want to bring up briefly. I think you may not see it as of yet. I think it's getting better in this country. I think when it comes to trying to have kids have new food, there was a book that was actually on one of the radio shows about a year ago called French Kids Will Eat Anything.
Right,
and
right.
They always try to have the kids in France just have a little taste and see how you feel about it. But I think what gives me hope is I really think more people throughout this country really do want to know where their food comes from. And I think a huge influence on that has been, and he's based really out of Milwaukee, is Will Allen and his group Growing Power, where people really are starting to get an appreciation for food and the urban agricultural movement. I mean, it's taken off like wildfire, and it's only going to get better.
Thanks for the call, Boyd. What do you think about that, Jeannie?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think people are certainly much more aware now over the last few years about what's happening to their diets and to their children as well, and they're looking for answers. Definitely. I think one interesting thing for me, in Italy, I don't really see them doing it the same way that the French do, where you give a child a little taste and they have to taste it. Because I was doing that with my son, and I noticed the one thing that he would never eat when I cooked them occasionally were red beets. And recently I gave them to him again, and he took an obligatory taste, and he said, "They're still disgusting." And it made me laugh, but it also made me realize that in the culture in which we live here in Rome, red beets aren't really, people don't eat them here. It took me a long time to even find them in the market, so I would go out to search for them. So I realize he doesn't have any backup for them. He doesn't see other kids eating them. He doesn't get them at school. He's not getting them anywhere except at home, where I sort of place them on a plate with a fork and tell them to eat them. So I think, you know, that's part of it as well, that what other people around you eat makes a difference to what you eat. And as more people are changing and becoming more concerned about the food, as the last caller suggested, I think that will also change for people as well. It will make it easier to feed your kids, you know, a variety of foods if they see other people eating them.
Jeannie, I'm wondering if Italian kids and their parents fight about food. I mean, we're not supposed to do that, according to all the best parenting advice. Don't get into a conflict over food. But it does happen. Parents have good intentions and they present the vegetable and the kid hates it and says it's disgusting. And then before you know it, you're fighting about food. Does that happen in Italy?
I think so. I'm sure it happens a little bit. I haven't seen that much of it because I think they're a little bit less anxious about the food, partly because they know that the children have eaten at school. And the really funny thing is that when they're really little, the teacher has a chart on the door and tells you, did your child eat the first course? Did they eat the second course? You know, they care about food here. So you would know whether your child had eaten or not without having to ask or speak to the child about it. And then also, you know, they tend to eat such a variety of foods that I think nobody gets too upset if a child, you know, one night doesn't eat very well or isn't really hungry. You know, it seems to be, they just seem to be a little bit more relaxed about it, so maybe a little less fighting over the vegetables. I don't know, it just seems a little bit easier going.
We'll go back to our callers now. We've got Barb with us in Crivets. Barb, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up?
Well, I just was listening as I was driving home from town, and I was thinking this summer how my grandsons were visiting. And I asked them what they wanted me to make because I wanted to treat them special and make their favorites. And they said, oh, Grandma, make liver and onions, and how about that creamy Reuben soup with the sauerkraut?
Oh, my gosh. And who are these grandchildren?
And they just ate it right up. And for me to take a beef roast or a pork roast and put it in a slow cooker with parsnips and rutabaga and potatoes and carrots, I mean, it's gone. So I guess I'm lucky.
That's great, Barb. And they could have my liver and onions, too. Jeannie, do we as parents in the United States not give kids enough credit for being willing to try stuff and not throwing different stuff at them?
I think that's true. I think we've been told there's kids' food, so we think, oh, well, then they should eat the kids' food that somehow or other it's meant for them. So, yeah, I think we don't try often enough to allow the children to just eat with the adults and eat what everyone else is eating. That's probably true. We're not giving them enough credit. Yeah.
Well, Jeannie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
That was Jeannie Marshall. Her new book is The Lost Art of Feeding Kids, What Italy Taught Me About Why Children Need Real Food.